You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic. Yeah. It's atomic.
Hey, this is Rod Adams, and I'm coming to you from Annapolis, Maryland. It's time for Atomic Show number 69. And Atomic Show number 69 is a follow-on to a conversation I had last week with Mr. Ray Haraldson, who I called an atomic tinkerer. He's a self-proclaimed Idaho farm boy who learned engineering and joined the Idaho National Reactor Testing Station in 1952 and had some really interesting experiences to share with us. And last week we talked a bit about his time with the EBR-1, Experimental Breeder Reactor Number 1, and the Borax series of reactors. That's the boiling water reactor experiments. And after our conversation, Ray remembered a few stories about EBR-1 that he thought were interesting and he wanted to talk about today. And then later on in the show, maybe we'll get around to talking about some really pioneering stuff with making electricity in its in a form that could actually be used by a city. But let's start off with some stories about EBR-1, the Experimental Breeder Reactor. And to refresh our memory, Ray, can you tell us a little bit about what that reactor looked like?
Well, that reactor was, by comparison to today, had a fairly large critical mass. It required like 50 kilograms of enriched uranium, and that's a lot. And nevertheless, the reactor itself was very, very small, only about the size of a football, and it come inherently with pretty high power density, higher than we'd like if you had some control over the design, about 1 kilowatt, kilowatt per cubic centimeter. It's not that you like it, it's that you get it whether you want it or not, and so for subsequent reactors which are of the breeder type, it was necessary to dilute the fuel and distribute it such that the power densities weren't that high. And it required, that was a very large quantity of enriched uranium-235 for the time, and it was hard to find that amount of uranium early on, right after World War II. And being in short supply and that supply being under the control of the military, they were a little reluctant to release enough to fuel the EBR-1. But they compromised and was done so, and with a stipulation that they'd be able to get it back very quickly if the political situation at the time became severe where they needed it, mm-hmm. in a form that could actually be used in nuclear weapons.
Yeah, to remind folks about the time frame here, you know, the U.S. just started enriching uranium for military uses. I think about 1954 was when the enrichment plant actually started producing reasonable quantities. And by the end of World War II, when we made the first few bombs, we only had produced enough, I think, to power one of the bombs. Actually, sorry, two of the bombs with enriched uranium, and that was all we really had. And after the war was over, of course, the U.S. decided it was going to shift its military posture to one of deterrence by using a large installed base of nuclear weapons. And we started enriching uranium pretty rapidly for the next period of time up until about 1950-51. It took a while to build the inventory. And, of course, there was also competition from the submarine program, which was beginning to get interesting about the same time as EBR-1 was being designed, if I understand the time frame properly.
Yeah, I think that agrees with what I remember about it.
Yep. So 50 kilograms of uranium, of course, that kind of sounds like a large amount, but as you say, it doesn't take up much space. Uranium is a pretty dense material. Was it in the form of uranium metal or an alloy with some other material?
Or? It really was pretty much pure enriched uranium. It ultimately was necessary to alloy it a little bit with zirconium to stabilize it because the thermal cycling caused the fuel to change shapes, and the zirconium was a way to stabilize that. But it was nearly bomb-grade uranium-235.
Yeah, uranium, I think, has several different forms as a metal depending on temperatures or neutron influx or something. I can't remember exactly what changes its form, but it changes size and shape, I think, in a neutron flux, if I dig deep into my memory banks.
Yes, and they'd make a point to try to roll it in a random way to keep it from preferentially going one direction.
Ah.
But the fuel inside EBR-1 was in the form of slugs about a little less than 3/8 inch in diameter and about 4.5 inches long.
Mm-hmm.
And they were put inside stainless steel rods and wetted with sodium potassium to conduct the heat away to the reactor itself.
That's that NAK stuff that you talked about last week?
Yes, we spoke of sodium potassium as MAC, and this is eutectic, which is a liquid at room temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it's it doesn't freeze as quick as water, so we're able to turn it on and off without heaters and almost treat it like it was like water in the pipes, but of course it was not. It's treacherous stuff if you get it out in the room with you. And we did occasionally have some MAC leaks we had to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
That's a situation you don't want to call a fire department unless they've been trained to deal with it, because they might just put water on it, and that's exactly what you don't want to do. It reacts violently with water.
Does it react more violently than pure sodium?
I think sodium, of course, would typically be solid. The straight sodium would be solid at room temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put water on it, of course, it's going to react, but it reacts from the surface.
Right.
But with NAC being liquid, water would penetrate into it, and you can get an honest-to-goodness explosion out of it. And, of course, it reduces the water back to to free hydrogen, which is reacting very quickly.
And mm-hmm.
There's a way to handle it, but you don't do it with water.
Well, maybe that's why we never even thought about using NAC for submarine use. We did use the sodium for the first or the second reactor that was powered the USS
Seawolf reactor, yes.
Right. Now, just as a quick aside, for those of you who aren't completely familiar with your periodic table, the reason that the word sodium and potassium gets abbreviated as NAC is those are the atomic designations for those two. Na is sodium and K is potassium, two of the more unusually designated elements in the periodic table. That's end of aside.
Yes.
All right, so after getting the military convinced that it was time to release some of this this uranium, of course, with the unusual stipulation you had to be able to quickly reform it into bomb-grade material if they needed it, I guess that drove some of the decision-making for what kind of form you used for the uranium.
Yes, so they would have to reprocess it, but it wouldn't be a major reprocess, but it did require, they required that the material be available to be returned to them on 30 days' notice. But, of course, if it had been in a reactor and been operating, it would be contaminated with fission products, and so there's a certain amount of reprocessing necessary.
Mm-hmm.
But that accounts for why the chemical processing plant, which is another facility at the NRTS, National Reactor Testing Station was built under emergency scheduling, and that's, I think, pretty much forgotten today.
Okay. So that reprocessing facility was right there if you needed it on the same site?
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so go ahead.
I think the thing that's more interesting about the EBR-1 was, of course, the follow-up after the accidental meltdown as a last experiment for the reactor before we were going to move our attention to the newer version, the EBR-2.
Mm-hmm.
But the meltdown occurred, and the interesting thing that I don't think has hardly ever been spoken by anybody is that we, given a free hand, we would have been inclined to look in the reactor and see what the damage was. The meltdown had not produced any kind of noise or explosion or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
The ship, but it was revealed itself by radiation leakage coming from the reactor, indicated that fuel had been damaged. But we were not permitted to open up the reactor and look in. And the story and the whole reason for that is unpublished. If you'd like, I'd go into that a little bit.
Yeah, I'd like to hear about that. Let's set the time frame. That was sometime in what year was that when the EBR-1?
The accident occurred in November 55, I think.
Okay.
I'll have to look to be sure what year.
Well, was it? Was it before the Borax experiments, or?
No, it was after.
After, okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so.
And we were not permitted to open up for an interesting reason, a political reason. If we opened up the reactor, it would release the gaseous fission products, the inventory of the, based on the history of the reactor operation. And among those fission products were fission gases, and they would come off. The non-gaseous fission products would stay behind. But releasing the gaseous portion of the fission products.
Those things like
a real problem.
Those are things like xenon and iodine and that kind of stuff?
Right. And particularly xenon, because at that time, the United States was monitoring the Russians by simply monitoring our own air and looking for xenon, which would be an indication that somewhere in the world someone had set off an atomic bomb or some variation of it. And this is the way we were monitoring them at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we were to open up this reactor and turn loose or whatever a xenon and other gaseous fission products might be involved, it might compromise the measurements that are being made.
Right.
So
xenon,
we were told, do not open up the reactor, leave it closed, and then wait for the xenon to decay, and then at some later time we would be allowed to look in and see really what had happened.
Hmm.
But we were also under a direction to say nothing about the meltdown, and that would have been easily, except that the then chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, Chairman Strauss, was giving a speech over in London where he made reference to the meltdown of EBR-1, and immediately our telephones began to ring, and with news media wanting to know more details, and we are still under orders to remain silent, and of course we mess is when we learned what news media do when you tell them that you can't tell them about something you know more about, and they want to know more about it. Well, they begin to make up their own stories, and at that moment, we were converted from people who were described by the media as brilliant scientists to incompetent scientists.
Yeah.
And from that point is where our reputation went downhill.
Well, you know, that's
it wasn't.
That's interesting, because the that idea of you know, controlling the story and trying to keep it secret, I think an awful lot of people have figured out that it's far better to come clean and tell the world what you know and be calm and factual about it, it certainly prevents somebody from making up their own story, or if they're going to make up a story.
True in that in that situation, because being told we were not to converse about it really irritated the news people, and it wasn't until March that we were allowed to actually open it up and look in.
Okay, so that's about 5 months later.
Yeah, and the damage was more severe than was anticipated. The central part of the core was pretty much melted. You could still detect individual fuel elements on the outer edge, but the inner portion of it had fused pretty much into a solid clinker.
Mm-hmm.
And there are pictures of it, and there is some official description of it in the literature that's still available, but some of the details on how that reactor core was removed is still unpublished, and it made things interesting for us. If you'd like, I'll go into that a little bit.
Well, certainly. I'd love to be the first to publish about things that aren't published somewhere else.
Well, here is a football-sized reactor inside a reactor tank that's fused into a solid chunk. How are we going to get it out? Well, what we did was we built a cave. When you know, cave is the word used to describe a cell which is sealed and which you do remote manipulation through very thick windows where you see what you're doing. Well, we had some very, very large concrete blocks, and these, by the way, had come from Borax, and stacked them up in such a way it formed a cave. And we installed in it one of those really 3-foot thick glass windows and put lights in there, and even some manipulators that allowed us to physically handle things. And then the core, which was actually lifted with the crane, the viewing crane, pulled up into that cave, but as it pulled the whole assembly, not just one rod at a time, but the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes up out of the reactor tank still dripping with MAC.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a pretty nervous situation, because while when in the reactor, it's all blanketed with argon inert gas, but when you pull it out into the atmosphere, it's the possibility of it catching on fire. And it did smolder a little bit, but it did catch on fire. And then when you get it up out of the reactor tank up into the cave, they used power hacksaws, remote controlled, to saw it into smaller chunks. But it ultimately come down to the actual core itself almost is one solid block. And they're able to separate some of the outer fuel elements that look more or less intact.
Mm-hmm.
It ends up with about a 35 kilogram chunk of uranium as a kind of a clinker.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still a lot of enriched uranium to have, and you have to worry about criticality possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be very nervous to be doing that today, even. But it was successful.
So it was really a clinker of uranium and some stainless steel from the cladding and that kind of stuff,
correct.
All mushed together.
And you can find pictures of it in the literature, still available today.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you get it out, then what are you going to do with it? Well, the small pieces were easy to handle, but that one solid clinker, 35 kilograms, what would we do with it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to tell you what we did with it. We built a lead-lined coffin with a cadmium spider built around it to keep it subcritical.
Mm-hmm.
It was sealed with gaskets with bolts heads around it, and we shipped it off to Chicago, and I do not know what happened to it after that. But we were glad to get rid of it.
Well, yes. If, of course, you know, if without anything changing in it, as long as somebody didn't like put it into water or some sort of reflector, probably wouldn't change its reactivity. So I guess that's why you...
Yes, and it was a leak-tight coffin that we made for it.
Mm-hmm.
Had it been in an automobile or in a traffic accident along the highway, it was solid enough that I think it would withstood almost any ordinary accident you can think of. Had it rolled off the truck into a canal, it would have still been leak-tight, and it still would have been subcritical.
Sure, because you...
Still, in today's world, you'd have a hard time shipping it.
Yeah, well, you had that cadmium around it, so it had a neutron poison,
yes,
neutron absorber.
Yes. So that's kind of the highlights of ABR2. ABR1, excuse me.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you weren't even allowed to investigate what caused the accident. Now, when you...
That's right. It was very frustrating to us. We really wanted to get a look in there, but... And the news media wanted no details, and we had very few to give them.
Right, and we had the discussion last time about exactly what the cause was in terms of the getting the positive temperature coefficient and having a little bit of a excursion there.
Yes.
Yeah, I think
it
that
was,
you...
the last experiment scheduled for the reactor before we were going to shut it down permanently and move our attention to the follow-up reactor, EBR-2.
Mm-hmm. Now, did the delay in doing that analysis slow down the design of EBR-2, or did they keep going without the knowledge?
They kept going with it, but guys like me, who was on the operating crew for EBR-1, had anticipated moving over and doing the same thing on EBR-2. Well, we were required to rebuild EBR-1. They would not let us walk away from a reactor that had been involved in an incident that was not totally explained.
Mm-hmm.
So EBR-1 was rebuilt. A new core was put in place. And then the experiments that went with it were exactly designed to elaborate upon what had caused the earlier meltdown. And it took us more than a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the experiment, well, now is done with a different approach, which was not so risky, using a way of slightly oscillating the reactor and looking for resonances. And finally, a report was able to be written where it very specifically clarified what really had happened. The negative temperature coefficient was made up of more than one component, and one was... fast and positive, and one was slow and negative, and if you take the two together and only change reactor temperature a little bit at a time, it looks like a, just a solid negative temperature coefficient, but under the conditions of changing flow, the temperature change too quick, and it reveals one component separate from the other, and that's what accounted for why the reactor meltdown occurred.
Yeah, it's always, and that's one of the reasons why I talk to people about this idea of tinkering a little bit without having some ability to do experiments on, you know, small reactors like what you guys were using, with obviously a lot of thought and calculation behind it. It wasn't most of the things that you were doing. You probably had a pretty good idea what was going to happen before you did the experiment, but you were at least able to do the experiment, and in some cases take the experiments all the way to the point where you knew what would happen in the worst possible case. I mean,
yes, the relative ability to freedom we had to do whatever we wished. Now, I don't want to imply that I'm the one that made such decisions. I was down the ranks further.
Oh, sure, sure.
Before I was taking orders for everything I did, but the relative freedom in concocting our own research program without oversight resulted in our getting answers very quickly for many, many things, and I think it's still a contributory fact to the world we live in today for what we did back in those days.
That's true. Of course, you know, when you think about the fact that we did have this meltdown that completely fused the core, and yet What happened to the container that the core was in? Did it get damaged much? Or?
No. The newly rebuilt EBR-1 was installed in the same reactor tank. There was no damage that far out. The core in the center, which, as I mentioned, is about football size, the tank is about 2 feet in diameter, and it had an inner blanket. That's a larger natural uranium rods. Those were largely undamaged. So it's just the core that's melted. But that was all replaced in the new reactor, and it was slightly different design, so it was not as vulnerable as the earlier version was, but it still allowed us to do the research to clarify what happened to the original core.
Right. So the core did melt, the core was damaged, but everybody lived to talk about it, and it didn't even damage the rest of the machinery around the plant, much less make the world go away or something.
That's right. The incident took place very silently with no immediate knowledge as to whether or not the reactor had actually been damaged. It was the only indication of the core damage was that there was radiation alarms which were monitoring the cover gas over the various tanks and components of the system were showing that there was contamination, and that meant that there really had been damage to the reactor core itself.
Right. That was probably caused by the release of the gaseous fission products from those sealed stainless steel clad tubes.
And yes, that's the way it transpired, yes.
Okay, and did EBR-1 operate on uranium the whole time, or did it have any other materials?
Well, I don't know whether anyone wants to remember it or not, but there was one full plutonium core built into that reactor before the meltdown. And that would be unthinkable today because, plutonium is more temperamental than uranium, and it's an alpha emitter, and you can handle it quite a bit different. But we had a full loading of plutonium, and it behaved similar to uranium, except for one significant fact, that you know about the delayed neutron fraction is what really determines how a reactor behaves. The delayed neutron fraction on plutonium is only about half what it is for uranium. And so it made our control rods worth almost twice as much reactivity-wise than they had been on the uranium core. But it was no particular difficulty to correct for it. We just, as operators, had to recognize that it was a little different animal than it was as a uranium reactor. But it was only there for a short time and then removed, and I don't think there was any significant experiments conducted with it.
Yeah, well, it was important, I think, to actually do that experiment with plutonium, because the whole idea of a breeder reactor is that you're able to, the initial cores get fueled with maybe enriched uranium, but follow-on cores need to use the fuel that was created in those initial cores, and that would be plutonium, right?
Yes.
You could
use a thorium cycle, but at that time we were only talking about a uranium-plutonium cycle.
Sure. Well, do you happen to know much about the testing of the blanket materials from EBR-1?
Well, to verify whether or not EBR-1 was truly a breeder, that is, if the conversion of the uranium to plutonium is a conversion of at least 1-to-1, then it's, by definition, it's a breeder. If it's less than 1-to-1, it's only a converter. And in this case, we viewed this being greater than 1 as being significant. And the maximum theoretical is about 1.2. Well, you had to sample that blanket material and send it to metallurgists to determine the quantity and distribution of it. And that was one of the major, that was the primary mission of the EBR-1, was to define whether it was possible and what that breeding gain number was. It turned out it was more than one, and it was done by analysis, metallurgical analysis of the natural uranium blanket that was around the core.
Was that analysis done at Argonne?
It was done back in Argonne, Illinois. We would ship slugs from the blanket back to them to check. In fact, even the outer, which air-cooled blanket, there was bricks out there, and they also did analysis on that also, and actually were able to, I believe there are reports on this, where they defined the distribution of the plutonium as it was formed, and it forms very initially in the early, in the close-in portion of the uranium-238 blanket.
Yeah, I would imagine the longer the reactor operates, the further out that plutonium gets formed, because some of that plutonium...
I would think so, but it's interesting that the, while we knew we had plutonium being formed, and you know we have to treat your plutonium differently than uranium, we never did. We worried about whether or not we might get plutonium free from the blanket claddings itself, but we never did. We were never able to detect any leakage of plutonium outside their containment.
Mm-hmm. Now, I imagine the uranium blanket material was also clad in stainless steel, maybe?
Yes, there was bricks on the air-cooled portion outside the reactor tank, the outer blanket. Those bricks were, I think they're about, not sure the weight, maybe 30 kilograms each. The control rods operated up through holes for them, but they were clad with stainless steel.
Mm-hmm.
And they were designed specifically in a shape so that they were wedge shapes forming the whole shape of the outer blanket.
Yeah, and I was interested.
I believe there are samples or dummies of those things in the Smithsonian Institute and elsewhere.
Yeah, I was interested when you talked about the fact that the control for EBR-1 was actually moving rods out of the blanket allow more leakage, I guess.
There are no good poisons for fast neutrons, but the mean freeing path of a fast neutron is so darn long that even if there's a control rod close into the reaction, fast neutrons, instead of slowing down, are being captured in the poison. It just tends to pass right through it. So if you want to stop a fast neutron, the first thing you have to do is slow it down, then you can capture it. Well, it meant that there was no really usable materials to be used as poison rods on a fast reactor. So you do the opposite. You put additional uranium in the control rods, and you insert them to increase the reactivity of the reactor, and yank them out for shutdown.
Yeah, I like to try to describe that to people as the way you control a charcoal fire by the vents at the bottom. You control the leakage in that core either by letting the neutrons out by pulling the reflector away, or making the neutrons reflect back into the core by adding material to the reflector region.
Yes, the analogy is really pretty good. A fire, bonfire is controlled so much by the surface to volume ratio, and that's what it is on a reactor as well.
Yeah. Well, when I try to describe how breeder reactors work, I talk about kindling and logs, with the enriched material being the kindling that makes a log, which you can't light with a match, into fuel.
Yes, and if you open up the outside edge of a little bonfire, it cools it down and it slows down.
Exactly. Yep, that's. I think it's a pretty reasonable analogy for anybody who spent much time lighting fires. And since I was a little pyromaniac when I was a kid, I understand it pretty well. I grew up in a suburb, but I used to love going camping with my dad and mom, and we'd go out and have campfires and roast marshmallows and all that neat stuff. And so I was always the kid that lit the fire, even if the wood was wet. All right, so go ahead.
You know, the information that we're able to provide to the world, that is really more so true when works experiments arrived at our site. And maybe that's what you'd like to go into. Is this the moment to do that?
I'm sorry, can you say what you just said again?
Well, the freedom we had to experiment was helpful on EBR1, but it was even more so and more effective and produced more usable information when we finally got into the boiling water world as well. And we lived in both worlds.
Yep.
And we had to change our thinking when we were operating on a water reactor because they behaved quite differently.
And I'm sure that having people that had experience on both types of reactors really deepened the knowledge and allowed you to... And I know that there are some folks that made some amazing technical discoveries and documented them pretty well. And I think we're still using most of that information and knowledge about delayed neutron fractions and absorption for various materials and all kinds of stuff today.
And I think it's really remarkable that we've inherited a world where that delayed neutron fraction was inherent in the material, and it turns out to be exactly the right value that allows you to build reactors and have bombs both.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Ray. I also sometimes think it's incredibly fortunate that we discovered fission before uranium-235 decayed away to a level so low that we wouldn't be able to start a reactor with natural uranium. If we had discovered it a few million years ago, we would have been able to have it easier because there was more uranium-235, and if we would have waited a few too many years, we wouldn't have been able to do it at all with natural uranium. So,
yeah,
kind of fortunate.
The world we've inherited is full of remarkable facts, and that delayed neutron fraction is such that with care you can have a nuclear reactor that's controllable.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it more complicated to make a bomb because it tends to slow the bomb down.
Mm-hmm.
If the delayed fraction had been really small, it'd be easy to make a bomb and hard to make a reactor.
Right.
It lands in a realm where it's possible to do both. And I marvel at that and think about it as a philosophical question as to how come it turned out to be what it is.
Well, here's another philosophical question for you. You know, the material that we use to clad the uranium fuel today is zirconium alloys. And zirconium has a wonderful characteristic of being resistant to corrosion in hot water, and it alloys well with other materials, and it has very little tendency to absorb neutrons. So it makes a wonderful cladding material. But it comes in nature contaminated with another material called hafnium. Hafnium has some of the hafnium has some of the same properties, and it's one of the best poisons there is. So as we figured out that we had to separate those two, we were creating perfect materials for water reactors. So I've always thought that was pretty amazing that we just happened to have this material left over, and we needed it for the control rods.
And the Borsch reactor was controlled by a combination of control rods, which were partly cadmium and partly hafnium.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most reactors don't use hafnium, but it's a good poison. And there's another similar characteristic of graphite. Most graphites, if they're not nuclear grade, are contaminated with some boron, which makes them very poor moderators, because boron absorbs the neutrons. But when you make reactor grade, you know, high purity graphite, you get rid of the boron, you take the boron out. So all kinds of philosophical things about this. I think it's kind of wonderful poetry that fission works the way it does.
it's part of the world we've inherited, and it's what we find and marvel about it.
Yeah, and of course I'm spiritual enough to say it's part of the world we were gifted, but...
I think I agree.
Okay. Hey, I think what I'm going to do is tease the people. If you don't mind, Ray, I'd like to have you on for one more show, and at that time we'll talk about the activities that led up to lighting of ARCO by a nuclear reactor power source, the first city in the world that was ever lighted by nuclear power. And Ray was part of that evolution and has some very interesting tales about the political situation that made that interesting and put some time pressures on, and exactly how the team of dedicated people stayed up for about 3 days in a row to make it happen.
Yes, we had to do it with a reactor that was scarcely built capable of doing the job. Given time, we would have corrected all those problems, but it made for an adventure of the whole event.
Yep, and sometimes that's the big cause of adventures that make it a worthwhile story is when people who don't have really quite what they need manage to do it anyway.
Well, that was the situation for sure. The reactor was not really quite designed to do the job. They had to kind of trick it into doing it, and I don't think the world knows much about that, even the residents of a little town, Arco, that was lit by this little reactor was, they know it happened, but they scarcely know the torment we went through to make it happen.
Now, is Arco the city that eventually renamed itself as the Atomic City, or is that something else?
There was another little town called Atomic City, but it doesn't hardly even exist today, but Arco likes to describe itself as the Atomic City. They have a little museum over there. It's on the other side of the desert from Idaho Falls, where I live, the other side of the NRTS, mm-hmm. and they like to remember the event, though the details of how it came about have never been published.
All right. Well, maybe we're going to change that. Next week we'll come back together, if you're up for it, and talk about the lighting of ARCO.
I think I should be available.
All right. Well, I hope you all enjoyed the show, the conversation, and keep those comments coming. Ray, just to let you know, there have been several folks that have commented on my other blog, Atomic Insights, that have thoroughly enjoyed the conversation and look forward to hearing more from you.
Very good.
All right. Have a good week.
Thank you, Ben.
Are you looking for a podcast that's on the cutting edge of what's new and exciting on the internet? A podcast for users about the things that matter to them? The Global Geek Podcast is this and more. A podcast about the latest technology news, reviews and interviews, applications and programs to make life easier, sites and services that are useful, fun, productive or just plain interesting. Not forgetting the Get Chicken segment. Presented by two hosts on opposite sides of the globe. We really are the Global Geek Podcast. Find us at www.globalgeekpodcast.com on the podcast network. Two hemispheres, two geeks, one podcast.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.